Hello and welcome to the Travel Diaries podcast. I'm Holly Rubenstein. I'm a travel and entertainment journalist. And here each week, I'll be speaking to a very special guest about the seven chapters in their life's travel diaries. From their earliest childhood travel memory and the first place they fell in love with, to their hidden gem and what's at the top of their travel bucket list, we'll be uncovering their adventures around the world and the travel experiences and destinations that have shaped their lives. Today, I am beyond excited to be joined by one of the world's most prominent wildlife filmmakers and presenters, Gordon Buchanan. Gordon has been filming wild and wonderful creatures in remote areas of the planet for over 30 years, capturing film across every continent apart from Antarctica. I feel like his face is ubiquitous on our TV screens here in the UK. There is just always a channel showing one of his many captivating and award-winning wildlife documentaries, from The Cheetah Family and Me and Snow Cats and Me to Animals with Cameras and Into the Wild. I spoke to Gordon last week. The sound is a little bit echoey, I'm afraid. We joked that we could say that he was talking to us from a cave somewhere in the wilderness, but he was actually at his home in Glasgow. And this episode, though, is really one of my very favourites. I'm often asked who is the nicest person I've interviewed for the podcast. And to be honest, all my guests have been so lovely in their own ways, but Gordon is just so delightful. I'm his new biggest fan. So his travel diaries take us from his childhood growing up on the remote Scottish island of Mull to his first job in Sierra Leone, close encounters with wolves in the Arctic, and discovering a new species of giant rat in Papua New Guinea. That and so much more coming up. So let's get started. Gordon Buchanan, welcome to the Travel Diaries. I feel like this has been a long time coming. I'm so excited to be speaking with you today. And just as you're back from an amazing looking trip in Scotland, I mean, you are in Scotland now, of course, it's where you live, but to the Isle of Mull, it looked beautiful. How was it?
Yeah, it was. The weather has been exceptional. and to go to... You know, for me, one of the most beautiful parts of the world, to go to the west coast of Scotland and spend 5 days as I did, you know, exploring places that, you know, a place that I grew up, places that I've thoroughly explored, but to sort of still see more and learn more and just rejoice in the natural world. It was really, yeah, it was such, you know, a special 5 days. And obviously the weather does make a huge, huge difference. And for finding animals, it helps as well, because when it's windy and rainy, a lot of animals don't tend to do that much. And if you're out at sea looking for marine life, when you've got 5 foot waves, it makes it quite difficult to find a little sort of fin of a dolphin that's only less than a foot high out of the water.
I mean, I know that you've interacted with pretty much every animal on the planet, but there is just something about dolphins, isn't there? I mean, Is there anything better than being followed by a pod of dolphins when you're out on the water? They're just such wonderful animals.
I think what makes it better, as I realised on this trip, was we were on a tour boat out of Tobermory. So there was a good 40, 50 people on that and loads of kids, little kids. And there was one little girl that her mum had said to me, she'd go, oh, she's desperate to see a dolphin. This is before we had the dolphin encounter. And I had, a couple of days previously, had taken a half-decent photo of a dolphin. I showed her this photo of the little girl and she was like, oh, wow, that's amazing. And then half an hour later, there was 200 dolphins. And for a good 40 minutes to an hour, surrounded, and this little girl and her sister were just staring over the front of the boat, just watching this
amazing
show of dolphins. And everybody on the boat, you know, at the end of the trip, just all these happy, smiling faces. So, one thing better than being surrounded by dolphins is being with people that are experiencing it too.
Oh, that's wonderful. And as you mentioned, you grew up on the Isle of Mull. I mean, so I have listeners all around the world who won't know much about it. It looks like an extraordinary place. Can you help bring it to life? What was it like spending your childhood there?
Yeah, for me, the Isle of Mull is a paradise. It is stunningly beautiful. It's an island off the west coast of Scotland. It's got, I think, 360 miles of coastline, so it's quite sort of rugged and indented, and there's lots of sea lochs that come in. But as you drive around the island, there's a huge variety of different habitats. There's some really mountainous bits, there's moorland, there's some beautiful big white sandy beaches, and there's rugged coastline and lots of wildlife. So it is, given that I've spent the last 30 years traveling around the world, you know, fortunate enough to go to some of the most special places and wild places, Mull is right up there. It is just one of the best places on the planet, and probably one of the best, well, actually, certainly in the UK, you know, a wildlife mecca.
What kind of wildlife would you go there to see?
Lots of otters. The kind of otter population is pretty much sort of maybe at saturation point. And because you've got so much coastline, you have this sort of, you know, lots of habitat for otters. A lot of river otters that you get on rivers and freshwater, they tend to be nocturnal, but on Mull, they pretty active, you know, active throughout the day. So it really depends on, you know, what they've caught. So they'll happily feed in the middle of the day or happily go out at night time. But
oh, that's so amazing, because they're so elusive normally, aren't they?
Yeah, they're really hard. I mean, the River Kelvin runs through the west end of Glasgow, close to where I live, and people have seen otters on that river. And I've gone out many, many times, especially over the last year and a half with having a lot more time on hand, and I've still haven't seen a Glaswegian otter yet.
I saw one just now, actually, when we were up in Scotland. We were staying near to Aileen Dolan Castle on the west coast. And at around 10:30 at night, we went down to the loch that overlooks the castle. And the castle was all floodlit, and the water was this inky blue, and an otter just floated past on its back.
Wow. Oh,
it gives me shivers just thinking about it. It's amazing, isn't it, how travel memories involving animals or involving wildlife really are the most special.
Definitely. I think I've always realized that something happens when you're watching wildlife, but particularly over the last year and a half. And I've heard more and more people talking about sort of being immersed in nature and paying attention to sort of wild things and just paying attention to the seasons. And it just basically gives you an opportunity to step out of your human shoes and become, you know, engaged and engrossed in something that's nothing to do with you, nothing to do with your problems. It is sort of, watching the wild world, and it's being a little sort of little, I always think it's a holiday from being human and having human problems. And that's why it is endlessly fascinating. It's not the kind of thing that you would think, well, I've kind of seen enough. I've seen enough otters now. Yeah. Just the other day up in Mull, and I was sitting, and I've seen otters many, many times before. And I was, you know, as excited now, actually, maybe more so. Actually, I think as I got older, sort of value all of these experiences a lot more.
That's so nice. Well, we are going to go on a journey through the 7 chapters of your life's travel diaries, and looking at all the places that you've filmed and worked, there's a lot of places to choose from. So I know it's going to be tough to pick, but we're going to start with chapter 1, which is your earliest childhood travel memory.
As we said, growing up on the Isle of Mull, there was lots to explore in and around Tobermory, where I lived. We didn't have a car when we were kids, so we didn't travel very far at all. All the sort of travel that we did go on holidays, so all the traveling we did was sort of on foot. Mm-hmm. As you get older, with each year, I suppose, you're like, okay, we'll go a little bit further sort of down the coast. We'll go to that hill that's a little bit further away. But when I was about 9 or 10, my best friend, his parents had a little boat, and they said, we want to come away for a few days in the boat. And for me, that was kind of one of my first proper holidays as a kid. Although we were just sort of walking down the main street, getting on a boat and heading out to sea, it was a chance to travel further than I had on the Isle of Mull. And we went away for a couple of days. And one of the days we went to the Isle of Lungar. It's part of the Treshnish Isles, and the Treshnish Isles are this extraordinary archipelago off the west coast of Mull. It's a violin chain that stretches out, and Lunga is a huge seabird colony. Thousands and thousands of seabirds. You've got razorbills and guillemots and shags, and you can see gannets. They don't nest on the island, but you see gannets offshore. But the big sort of most numerous bird there are the puffins. And as a child of 9 or 10 years old, it was like being transported. It was sort of like kind of a Conan Doyle sort of lost world that you're entering, because I didn't realize that you could have a natural spectacle like that in Scotland. I'd sort of, you know, loved watching wildlife documentaries and sort of watching the old sort of Attenborough documentaries, and he'd travel to the Galapagos or somewhere that we have that abundance of life and animals that you can get very, very close to. So when we set foot on Lunga and climbed up onto the cliffs, and there were puffins everywhere, and you could sit just a meter from these gorgeous little birds, and they happily just do their puffiny thing, and there's birds wheeling overhead. So it was, as an experience for a child, it was really overwhelming. But at the time, I just thought, I didn't know that this was on our doorstep. I didn't know that you could sort of, you know, have this abundance of life, mm-hmm. and something that is, you know, was so inspiring, I suppose. You're just sort of half a day journey from the town where I'd lived.
It's interesting that the place that you choose as well that first comes to mind is associated with nature. I mean, would you say that your passion for wildlife and the environment and nature dates back then to that point?
I would say so. I always sort of cite the fact that I grew up on the Isle of Mull as of, you know, it became a foregone conclusion that I was going to end up doing this job. But that experience on the Cheshire Isles, yeah, that was really important, because I think I got such a kind of rush from being there and being close to those animals. And I didn't have a camera. I wasn't a sort of junior naturalist. I just, something about that experience really struck a chord within me. And it's not until I say it now that I think, well, gosh, I've now spent 30 years getting very, very close to wild animals. And that was the first time that it happened. So yeah, maybe without that experience, that would have been the little sort of...
a real sliding doors.
Yeah, that could have done something completely different. But yeah, it's the easiest one. That question, when you ask me, that's what my mind goes to, and I can't think of it sort of any other travel experience as a kid that sort of moved me in that way, or was as important, really.
Now, those islands that you stay on, or are they ones that you just visit for the day?
Originally there was a local population there, but they would have probably sort of in the Highland Clearances sort of moved off. So there's an old village up there on Lunga. Years later, I think sort of when we were teenagers, I hadn't been back to Lunga for maybe sort of 5 or 6 years. Mm-hmm. And there was this sort of draw. And I suppose as kids, we were like, we have to go back there. Me and my friend was like, we have to go back to Lunga. And then eventually when we were old enough to go by ourselves, we got my friend's uncle, who was a fisherman, to drop us off on Lunga with tents and water and all of our supplies. And we spent sort of 4 or 5 days there. And I've gone back many times since then. I think sort of through my sort of teens and early 20s, I went back and sort of camped a couple of times, because it was not only was it a, you know, as magical experience, you know, being a bit older, there's something about it that sort of catapulted me back to that first time that I visited. And yeah, I was there again last week.
Oh, really?
And it's a very, very special place in a global context. Yeah.
Sounds wonderful. One to take note of. Well, moving on to chapter 2, that is the first place that you fell in love with.
Oh, I'm sort of trying to sort of pick places that aren't the Isle of Mull. We've talked enough about Mull, and that's a given that I fell in love with that place.
How lovely to fall in love with the place that you grew up in, though.
Yeah, I think my wife always says, when people ask you about kind of most special places, don't keep saying Mull, but but let's move on from Mull. I think one, the place that I completely fell in love with was the Arctic, the high Arctic. I, for years, I'd spent a lot of time filming in the tropics, and then sort of wasn't really until the last 15 years I started sort of filming in more temperate climates. And in 2014, I had this opportunity to go to Ellesmere Island up in the Canadian Arctic to film wolves. And a friend of mine, a colleague, had been there before, and he said, "I'm not sure you're going to like Ellesmere Island." And I said, "Why is that?" He said, "Because it's just quite monotonous. It's not a very beautiful place because it's just rolling tundra." And I was like, okay, so I sort of lowered my expectations. But when I got there, I was just blown away by this place. That it was, you know, one of the wildest places on the planet. I think importantly, it's a part of the world that, although obviously there are changes happening there due to climate change, but there's no roads, there's no buildings, there are no people. It's so high up, it's not on any flight path, so you don't see kind of vapor trails or planes going over the top. So when you stand out there on the tundra, there's nothing but tundra and ice between you and the North Pole. And I was struck it sort of when I was there, and I sort of left the rest of the team, and I was a little bit further north, and I thought, I could be the sort of most northerly person on this planet at this moment. And the clarity of the air is such that you look at a mountain off in the distance, and you think, okay, that's maybe like a thousand feet tall and maybe 5 miles away. And you look at a map and you realize it's 45 miles away, and it's a towering, you know, huge, huge mountain. It's a place that plays tricks on you, because the geology and that sort of the form of the tundra isn't something that you can have any comparison to, because the land looks very different, because it's land that's been shaped. Once the ice melts, this landscape has been shaped by, you know, this thousands of years of freezing and thawing and freezing and thawing. So when you look at a landscape, it looks quite alien. And because there's no trees, there's no sense of like how far that next ridge is. And it plays tricks on you. So you'd be like, okay, I'm going to go to that distant hilltop. And you start walking, and 10 minutes later you're there. And I thought it was much further away. And on other occasions, I'm going to go to that hilltop, and 5 hours later you're still walking in that one direction. But the most special thing there, you know, those, all the wildlife, but the wolves particularly, as I said, because there are no people there, the animals that live there have no fear of human beings. They've got no preconceived ideas of how dangerous we can be. So yeah, to be in an extraordinary place and to have close encounters with a pack of wolves, so close that literally they would be sniffing your boots as you're sitting there. So as close to a wild wolf as you can really ever get.
That's so interesting that they came up really close, that they weren't fearful of humans. I would have thought that it would be the other way around, that because they'd never seen a human, that they'd be even more scared. So they came right up close. That must have been so thrilling.
Well, on the very, very first day, we had all of our kits. We had to be so remote, we had to get choppered in. So all of our equipment was in the chopper, unloaded everything, the chopper powered up. And as it disappeared, just over the ridge in front of me came this big white wolf that started walking straight towards us. And I thought, this is obviously a blind wolf, because why would it be walking straight towards us? And it obviously heard us and smelt us and thought, okay, what? And these wolves had never seen people before. And that was its response. There wasn't even sort of any real caution. I think they're the top predator on Ellesmere Island, so they have nothing to fear. So these animals have been born, raised, knowing that they literally are top dog. So it's like, well, what have I got to fear? It's like, and it walked up and had a good sniff around this big pile of equipment, and I was blown away. And then over a sort of course of weeks and months, we spent, you know, every single day with those wolves, and they got used to us being around, and that sort of, they were as curious about us as we were about them. So
what a magical experience.
It's hard, very, very hard to beat somewhere like that. Given with, you know, I'd been to Yellowstone before, and there what was considered a close encounter with a wolf was a wolf maybe on 200 meters away, whereas in Ellesmere Island, you know, these animals just sort of have no fear of people. And that's sort of, yeah.
There must be so few places left like that as well on the planet, the opportunity to go somewhere like that.
Yeah, really, this sort of, you can go to the sort of, you know, deepest, darkest rainforest and you still, you're aware of humanity. So I sort of, yeah, that was working up there in 2014. Was, as I was saying earlier on about being immersed in nature and having a holiday, you know, an encounter, an experience with a wild animal is like a holiday from being a human, all your problems. It was sort of kind of forgetting about all of humanity. It's sort of, yeah. You're up there, people have not made their mark, visible mark, on that part of our planet. And yeah, when you combine that with this whole range of extraordinary creatures that live up there year round, it sort of makes for quite a heady mix.
Amazing. Well, just going back to the beginning of your career and your journey to becoming a cameraman, I mean, that really happened by chance, didn't it?
Yeah, completely. I was working in a restaurant when I was still at school. When I was 15, I thought I better try and get a job and get some cash. And the restaurant was called The Captain's Table. And Anne Gordon, who owned The Captain's Table, her husband was a wildlife cameraman. And I didn't know him personally, but I knew what he did. And I thought, oh, that's interesting. But it was through working with Anne that I kind of learned more about Nick's job. And I was sort of the year later when I was 16 and really didn't have a clue what I was going to do in life. I thought, that sounds like the most amazing job, and got quite focused. I thought, okay, I've got to find a job. I sort of really should have some kind of career. So I thought, maybe that. I mean, well, because Nick himself, you know, he left school without any qualifications. He had sort of done a whole range of different jobs. He'd been an estate agent. He owned a chip shop for years. And then he kind of sort of found his way into wildlife filmmaking. So I thought, well, I'll chat to Nick about it and just sort of see what advice he has that can hopefully take me in that direction. And just when I was 17, I helped Nick out with various things at home and sort of dead keen and sort of, you know, he said, can you run down to the post office and, you know, post this for me? He didn't literally mean, can you run down? But I thought, right, okay, here's a job. I think being at school and not being academic at all and not being engaged by school. Mm-hmm. And I think the teachers probably thought I was just a numpty. So when Nick said, run down to the post office, that's what I did. I ran down to the post office and ran back up. And he was like, have you been? I was like, yeah. And then sort of that pretty much sort of over the course of weeks, I was doing all these little jobs for him. And he got this project in Sierra Leone and he needed an assistant. And he said, would you be interested in being my assistant in Sierra Leone for a year and a half? And he said, obviously you'll have to, well, two things, you'll have to leave school and you need to pass your driving test. So I thought, well, leaving school is not a problem at all. And I'm pretty sure I'll be able to pass my driving test. So I did. And that was it. Sort of as soon as, you know, that had happened, he said, you've got the job. So wow. I literally went into school the next day. And instead of taking a left to go to, you know, a sort of geography lesson, I went right to the headmaster's office and said, that's me, I'm leaving. Where are you going?
I thought you were going to say, I went right to Sierra Leone.
I'm off to Sierra Leone. He was like, bye. And that was it, really. It was sort of being in the right place at the right time. And that's, which is a secret to filming wildlife, is sort of you've got to be in the right place at the right time.
Serendipity.
And yeah, sort of so grateful to Nick for that opportunity, because it was a huge risk taking, you know, a kid off to, you know, the other side of the world, and it was really an intense time.
So, I mean, you had this wild lifestyle on this beautiful Scottish island, and then, I mean, what was it like? Was that the first time that you got on a plane as well?
Yeah, it was the first time being on a plane. The first time I'd been to Germany on a school trip, so that's abroad. But we went on a bus, a two day bus journey to Germany, but it was kind of similar to home. So
I mean, what a culture shock for that to be the first place you'd ever really travel to and to spend such a long period of time there. I mean, what was it like?
Yeah, I mean, there's not, culture shock doesn't really cover it. I wasn't Nick had travelled extensively around the world at that point, and he was sort of, he spent a lot of time trying to prepare me mentally for going to this strange place. And when I got there, nothing can, and especially back then, you know, that was in, it was January the 4th, 1990 that we left. There wasn't sort of, people just didn't have that same knowledge of other parts of the world. And as a kid, you know, I wasn't probably even engaged on things that were, you know, if countries like that popped up in the news, I was outside. I was never sitting in watching the news. So it was akin to being dropped on another planet. It would be, you know, if they'd taken me to Mars, that would have been less strange than me going to Sierra Leone, because it's, yeah, culturally extraordinary. You've got some beautiful rainforest. It's Africa. The temperature's different. The food's different. Everything about that whole experience was utterly different from anything that I'd ever experienced before.
What were you actually going there to film?
We were based on an island in the middle of a river, in the sort of south of the country. There was kind of some intact rainforest, but this island was a division between two chiefdoms, and there'd always been dispute over who actually owned, which tribe owned the or which chief owned the island. So subsequently, it wasn't farmed or logged or inhabited. And on this island, there was towering rainforest, but lots and lots of animals. It was, you know, probably still is one of the most sort of densest populations of primates in the world. So there was lots of different species of monkeys and chimpanzees and a whole range of different sort of, you know, unusual creatures that lived there. And wow. We set up a tented camp, and that's where I was for a year and a half. I came home halfway through, but yeah, my life from the age 17 to 18 and a half was in a little tent in the jungle.
Unbelievable. And I mean, did you fall in love with that career path from that point onwards?
No, quite the opposite.
Really?
Part of me now would love to go back and experience that, or have that same experience as an adult, because I think I would have valued it a lot more. But at 17, I was desperately homesick. Mm-hmm. I think from the moment, the moment I stepped off the plane and had this sort of, you know, into this other world, I thought, I've made a big mistake. This is all too different.
Really? Yeah. For me. It must have been so overwhelming.
And very aware that, you know, at that stage of life, 17, you've got, you know, sort of full independence from your parents, and all my sort of mates were about to go off to college in Glasgow, and they'd got a shared flat together, and we'd sort of go out and go into parties and just sort of being 17, I was really homesick. So it's pre-internet days and satellite phone days. So to communicate, it'd be this sort of 2 month sort of cycle. I'd write a letter. Once a month, Nick would go to Freetown, post all of our letters, pick up any letters that had been sent to us and bring them back. And then the communication. I mean, it's amazing, like, to think back that I could pick up my phone and text anyone anywhere in the world that has a phone signal and have a conversation back and forward with them, whereas this was sort of, you know, every 2 months you could get a little message out to the to planet Earth. Oh,
yeah, I mean, that must have been so hard, but I mean, thank goodness you carried on, because that was the start of us being able to see your incredible work. I mean, chapter 3 is the place that you learned the most about yourself. It seems like you learned obviously a huge amount about yourself there.
Well, that's sort of, yeah, it's a nice segue, because I think it was Sierra Leone at that age, really, you know, it's such a cliche, but sort of I arrived there as a boy and left a man.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like, a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare tri-term medical plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Today's episode is supported by Airbnb, and what a great partnership. If you're a longtime listener of the Travel Diaries, you probably know that we love to put our home on Airbnb when we're traveling. Like last autumn when we took the family to Puglia, we put our house on Airbnb when otherwise it would just be sitting empty, which meant that we earned some extra money that went towards our flights and maybe some souvenirs too. Hosting on Airbnb for us is also a family affair. My mum is an Airbnb superhost. She regularly has guests stay in her little chalet in her garden. And my dad, who lives in France, has his home on Airbnb so that when he comes back to visit, he is earning some extra money while he's away. My dad is 80 and he only started hosting on Airbnb a couple of years ago. So hopefully that shows you how straightforward the whole experience is. He found it so easy to list his house that I think he's got all his pals signing up now too. And it really is straightforward. You can choose whether you want to rent out your entire home or just some rooms. Alex and I, for example, list our spare bedroom and that works really well for us. So if you have a trip coming up and you want to earn some extra money while you're away, your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.co.uk/host. That's airbnb.co.uk/host. Thank you to Airbnb. What I particularly love about a lot of wildlife documentaries now is that we're taken behind the camera. We see the work that goes into shooting shows like yours and the extreme patience that's required. It's, you know, it's not an easy job at all. It's not like the wildlife just turn up on day one and there you go on to the next. It's a huge test of patience, of your resilience. And, you know, we see that story, don't we, of waiting, and then finally it emerges. So with that in mind, you know, what has been the most rewarding payoff? What has been the most rewarding shot to capture?
Yeah, the patience is sort of, you know, I don't find that a challenge to sit for hours and days or weeks waiting for something to happen, because as the years have gone on, I've got this sense, sort of gut feeling, that I know when I'm in the right place. Mm-hmm. And I certainly know when I'm not in the right place. And, you know, if I feel that I'm in the right place, it is just a matter of time, just sort of wait. You're kind of daydreaming. You've got this opportunity to sit by yourself and have these sort of, you know, mindful experiences when you're watching the way that the light changes. You're looking, sort of able to tune into tiny details of sort of, you know, an insect landing on, you know, on a flower, or sort of a bird flying off in the distance. It's just how the temperature changes and the clouds roll in and roll out. So if you are interested in the natural world, it's easy to sit for you know, that time. But in Mumbai, this is sort of going to maybe six years ago, and I had been sent to India to try and film these urban leopards. So there's a national park, Sanjay Gandhi National Park, which sort of used to be beside Mumbai, but Mumbai has grown up around this little island of green, and there are leopards and a whole range of other wildlife living there. And the producer for the second Planet Earth 2 had sent me there to try and get shots of these urban leopards. And he had said, it's going to be incredibly challenging because leopards are notoriously elusive. He said, but do not come home if you don't get at least one shot of a leopard with the city behind it. He said, that is sort of like, you're going to have to go to sort of witness relocation. You have to get a shot of that. And we can make it work. Yeah.
No pressure.
And on the very first night, I set up my hide and I'd had a good look at the area, and I'd filmed leopards a lot before, and there's sort of obviously, you know, field craft that comes into play. And I thought, I'm going to put the hide here for the first night and see how it goes. And on the very first night, I think it was an hour after dark, this leopard came out of the forest and I hit record, and it walked through my frame with these apartment blocks and the city lights behind, and the leopard walk through the frames. I was like, I can go home now. No, that, I thought, well, that's the shot that I will be able to go home eventually. But then I spent the next 30 nights, every single night, just sitting up, getting closer and closer to getting the Holy Grail, which was a hunting sequence with these leopards, and I got it. And that was really rewarding, amazing. Because often with wildlife filmmaking, you never meet your expectations. You always think, okay, you're going for the Holy Grail, and you always sort of more often than not fall short, and you leave thinking, well, it would have been good if we had just one extra go at it, or if this had happened, or if the lighting had been different. With those leopards, knowing how challenging it was going to be, at the end of the 30 days I sort of packed everything up and, well, there we go, did it. And I think that is the longest that I've spent just focused on sort of one species. Yeah, the danger is you spend too long by yourself that you're not really desperate to get rejoin society. So at the end of this month, I was like, oh no, it's just back to being with people.
Well, moving on to chapter 4, that is your all-time favorite destination. I know you've been to all continents apart from Antarctica, so you know, I know it must be incredibly hard to pick, but which comes to mind first?
A place that I really fell in love with was the Great Bear Rainforest in Canada. We were there for a couple of weeks trying to film wolves, and it wasn't that successful. We eventually did see some wolves at the end of the trip, but we were based on a boat just working our way through that part of the world. Anyone that sort of doesn't know where the Great Bear Rainforest is, sort of, it's off the west coast, so it's kind of British Columbia. I didn't know anything about that area, so I hadn't researched it. I knew that we were going to film wolves, but I didn't, you know, hadn't Googled it. I hadn't sort of looked at any images of this place, and it is a really beautifully wild part of Canada. Lots of sort of, I suppose, fjords and inlets and sort of sea lochs and these river channels that come way, way, way inland. Huge amounts of forest, and it's got that kind of lost world feel about it. And there's kind of destruction and devastation and sort of, you know, humanity around that area. But for most of those 2 weeks, we were again in this sort of a part of the world that was so wild that we didn't see, you don't see the signs of people, and you don't see that sort of destruction in your immediate surroundings. And again, didn't bump into anyone once we actually left the little town. So we were just exploring and seeing, you know, seeing whales, seeing wolves, seeing eagles, seeing bears. It was at the time of the salmon run. So it was getting a sense of what the world was like before humans started monkeying with everything. So we're so used to sort of the planet as it is now, and you know, we don't realize, and we live in our towns and cities, that, you know, at one time Glasgow, at one time London, these were wild places full of wild animals, and you have to kind of go off the beaten path to find places like that in the modern world, and these very special places still exist. And the Great Bear Rainforest, again, yeah, it's sort of a wild place. Since I left there, I've been trying to find a way to get back. You know, a lot of the times you go to a place and think, okay, well, I'm happy to go home. But that was a place I thought I'm happy to go home, but I'll definitely be back here. So in the years of immediately after, I was like trying to get back and trying to find some project that would take me back. And it's still, I haven't been there. So that's, yeah, coming up for 10 years now. But it's, yeah, Google the Great Bear Rainforest and do an image search, and you get an idea of what the place is like.
Chapter 5 is your hidden gem, an undiscovered place that you love. I mean, that to me sounds like the ultimate hidden gem. I mean, you must have discovered so many over the years. What was your pick for your hidden gem?
Well, that is kind of a very hard one, because practically everywhere that I'm sent through work, every place that I gravitate towards in, you know, out of my own interest, are all hidden gems. So the River Kelvin That for me is a hidden gem. Loch Lomond, it's not particularly hidden, but that's a place that I go to and just sort of love, because it's one of these places that never fails to sort of engage you. But I think a good candidate, or the strongest candidate for my hidden gem, is Mount Busavi in Papua New Guinea. Wow. We went there for an expedition. It was part of the Lost Land series, so that was part of the series called Lost Land of the Volcano. And Mount Busavi is an ancient volcano that is completely covered in rainforest. It's in a remote part of Papua New Guinea. It's a classic volcano shape, so huge crater, very, very steep slopes. The ridge itself it's very difficult to get into it. So subsequently, few communities and tribal groups that live in that area didn't go there. It's too steep-sided. Once you climbed up, they said that they did occasionally climb up to the ridge, but the last thing they wanted to do after 2 days schlepping through the jungle was actually start climbing down into this huge crater. When I mean huge, it's sort of miles and miles across, and you look down from the edge and it's forest and sort of rivers running through. And part of the expedition was exploring that part of Papua New Guinea, but the final sort of 10 days was a sort of little satellite expedition into the crater of the volcano. So we went there not knowing what to expect. And again, it was a lost world, a place where there were no people. There's a theme here that all these favorite places of mine, it's like, there's nobody there. That's why I like it. But yeah, we had to be choppered in, sort of found a little clearing where you could land the chopper with all the equipment that we needed, all of our camping equipment, and we started to explore. And not only did we find the animals that we expected to find there, we found a whole range of new species
animals that
had never been discovered. So
tell me about some of the species that you found.
Well, there was a few. Even now you can find new species of, there are new species of insects, new species of little mammals, new species of bats that are found deep sea. Yeah, there's sort of, our world is sort of far from fully explored. And that list of, what do we share this planet with grows. In Busavi, we found a new species, which was the world's largest species of rat. So it is sort of, a meter and a half long, this huge.
Oh my God.
And it looks like a rat. It's not sort of, there's no scale, you would just think it was sort of, it does look unusual. Its features are sort of pretty enlarged, but this animal is humongous. I think meter and a half, maybe 2 meters sort of from nose to tail. And then.
Was it terrifying?
No, the animals there, because there are no people there, those animals don't have any fear of people. And like I was saying with the wolves, that is a sort of, common theme with animals that don't have any experience of people.
I mean, as humans, we're predisposed to think that rats are just, they're not that lovely, are they? I mean, although, of course, some people have them as pets, but I mean, the idea of a 2 meter one. So, like, for example, I'm arachnophobic, and then sometimes I watch nature documentaries and they show like a meter long spider, and I think I'd have a heart attack. Like, that would be the end of me. So, are there any animals that you've actually encountered that you've been like, oh my God, this is the most terrifying thing I've ever seen?
Well, I did used to have a slight irrational fear of rats. So yeah, there was one of those creatures that I was never that keen on. I think when I was a kid, he was slightly traumatized. My friend had some rabbits, and there was a plank of wood or sort of a board in his rabbit enclosure, and this rabbit had given birth under this board. And he said, after school, we'll go up and look at these baby rabbits, tiny little things. And Nori and I went into the rabbit enclosure and pulled up this board. And there had been this massacre. A rat had got in and had killed all these baby rabbits. And the rat was still there. And it got a shock as we lifted up the board. And it was a fairly small enclosure with sort of chicken wire around it. And this rat tried to get out. and started leaping kind of really high in the air, sort of like bouncing off the fence and sort of leaping past us as little kids. It's horrible. So yeah, that slightly scarred me. But then, yeah, my wounds were healed when we, you know, encountered this giant rat that was so docile. You could sit right beside it and sort of tickle its whiskers. I don't know what you are, but yeah, you're not doing any harm. And all those animals sort of in the crater were, yeah, just you could literally walk right up to them.
How amazing.
Inconsequential. So yeah, that was an extraordinary place, and we've been so lucky to go to a place that not that few people go to, that no one went to. You know, there's a kind of, you know, there's only the group of us that team that went into the crater that have been there. I'm not sure if anyone's actually been back since there. So yeah, some places in the world you think, okay, so few people must have been on this ridge or walked through this part of the forest. But in Busavi, you knew that every footstep you took, that no one had been there before.
What a thrill.
First humans to explore that crater.
What an unforgettable experience. A complete contrast then. Chapter 6 is your worst travel experience.
That is the trickiest one, I think, really. But there has to be one, and there is one. I've been lucky in that over the years, all of these places that I've gone to, you know, one thing that can spoil any experience, it's not the weather, it's not the insects, it's not the food, it's the people you're with. So as I was saying right at the very beginning, you know, to be on that boat surrounded by dolphins and people that are rejoicing in that experience, that was amazing. And they were a lovely group of people. But, you know, there are some people that are just a right pain in the backside. And I've been occasionally on trips in amazing parts, really amazing parts of the world. And that sort of those exceptional individuals that seem to kind of rejoice in negativity or just sort of, that's mainly it. I kind of can forgive lots of sort of, you know, odd behavior, but people that are constantly negative, I really struggle with. But I think the worst travel experience, you know, on one hand, it was an amazing experience, but on the other hand, it was really tough. I went to Russia back in 2008, and the plan was to try and look for Amur tigers, so Siberian tigers. Mm-hmm. So I hadn't been to Russia before. I didn't really know what to expect. And we were over in the far east of Russia, and it was completely different from anywhere that I'd been before. You know, the sort of towns and cities of, you know, quite grim, sort of that Soviet influence of how the cities kind of, you know, grew. There's nothing aesthetically beautiful about, you know, the towns, and everything was really quite grim. Mm-hmm. And I spent a month traveling around that part of Russia. When you get out into the countryside, it is really, really beautiful. But at no point in this month did I see a tiger. And as the days went on, I thought, this is really not going to happen. It's like looking for a needle in a haystack. There's so few. I mean, technology now, just sort of, you know, 12 years on, there are things, equipment that we could have taken with us that would have probably heightened our chances. But this was really kind of old fashioned, just get out there and just keep searching. And we were staying in some real hovels. Some places we stayed in little kind of cottages, hunters' cabins out in the woods, and they were lovely. But a lot of the time we were staying in a kind of Russia's equivalent of a motel. So they're really, really shabby places. And all of that I could have dealt with, but I was only with one other person, and he was a miserable sod. He was just nothing. God. We could make him happy. So I spent a month of my life looking, it would be like looking for the Yeti. I think you're never going to find this, staying in sort of pretty grim accommodation. And most of the time he just sort of, I think he was smoking 50 fags a day. So in the day, and we were driving for long periods of time, and he was chain smoking.
Oh, no.
And I said, can you open the window? But it was minus 25. I said, no, I'm not going to open the window. So that, as a travel experience, was, yeah.
And your lungs aged as well.
Yeah, being stuck in a four-wheel drive in a fairly grim part of Russia with a chain smoker, knowing that we were not going to see the animal that we were after.
Did you find it? Did you find it in the end?
No.
Oh, how disappointing.
No, we got fairly close, but no coconut.
I'm sure you ask this a lot, but when we watch your programs, you get extremely close physically to quote unquote dangerous wild animals. And in your commentary, you might say, you know, your heart's racing, that it's a nerve-wracking experience. And then you get to know how the animal works and see it less in that light, less of a threat. But I mean, have you had any close encounters with an animal that you've been shooting, or a wild animal, where you feel like it was kind of tipping the balance of being actually really scary?
In the sort of early days of my career, I didn't know as much, and I was sort of not as risk averse as I am now. So I would get myself into these situations that I wouldn't risk assess that situation. So I'd go off into the forest happily by myself in places where there are big, potentially dangerous animals, and not ever think, okay, well, if I bump into an elephant, if I bump into a bear, what am I going to do? And I'm so fortunate that I kind of got through that sort of cavalier period of my life without anything sort of too bad happening. But yeah, at that time, one of the most terrifying things, I'd been walking through the forest one morning, climbed up onto the sand dunes to get a view out to sea. This is in Yala National Park in Sri Lanka. And I climbed onto the sand dunes, and I was looking out to sea, and the sun was just coming up, and I hadn't looked around me, and I sort of noticed some elephant prints, and I was like, oh, wow, they look quite fresh. And I looked over, and there was this huge bull elephant, maybe just sort of 20 meters away, and it was standing with sort of in the open beside a bush, and I hadn't seen it in my peripheral vision. And I looked over, and as I looked over, it didn't realize that I was there, and it looked at me. And I thought, okay, if I just hold my nerve, it'll probably just go back to doing what it's doing. But elephants are, you know, as amazing creatures as they are, they can be, if they've had bad experiences with people, they can be very, very dangerous. Mm-hmm. And this bull elephant, as it turned out, had sort of had some bad experiences, encounters with people, and had been sort of shot at and had sort of spears thrown at it. So it did not like people. And when it saw me, it just shook its head a couple of times. And what I should have done was sort of slowly back away, but I thought it'll probably turn tail and disappear. And instead it just ran straight at me. And I thought, right, okay, I'd been told that if you just don't budge, an elephant will actually stop its charge. It'll skid to a halt. So I thought, I'll try that and see what happens. And this elephant just covered the ground very, very quickly. And it got to within maybe sort of 8 meters of me. And I thought, bugger this. I just tore off down the sand dunes and made for cover. And I looked over my shoulder, and the elephant was right there running after me. And I fortunately got into the tree line and started zigzagging through the trees. And I could hear the elephant sort of crashing through the bush behind me, but it kind of got confused. And because I was zigzagging, I managed to get away. So that, you know, that was a very
heart and mouth experience.
A lucky escape. And I've been chased by on the same project, wandering through the forest and bumping into sloth bears. And sloth bears, despite their name, are not particularly slothful. A human being that happens on them in the forest, and I've been chased by them a couple of times. But so yeah, there's something about, you know, you think of the fears that human beings have. You know, fear of losing your job, fear of sort of, you know, your house being broken into. But really, fear, formed as it is within people, is a sort of primal response to threat.
Yeah.
And that is sort of threat from bigger things that are going to eat you or squash you. So
ultimate fight or flight.
Exactly. Yeah. A big animal chasing you through the forest. You're kind of going way back in time to sort of, you know, doing what humans do best, which is just run away from things.
Yeah. So we are on to the final chapter of your travel diaries. That's chapter 7, which is the destination that's at the top of your bucket list. But I wondered if I could actually make it a dual-pronged answer and ask not only the destination, but also the animal that you maybe long to film that you haven't yet captured that would also be at the top of your bucket list?
I have been to India and Africa and South America and North America many times, been to Australasia. And so I've been to every continent in the world but for Antarctica. I love the Arctic, and I know that I would love Antarctica. And I've had various opportunities over the years to go there, but because it takes such a long time to get there, and when the kids were young, I didn't want to have to go away for a prolonged period of time. So you can't really do it in a sort of, you can't do it in a 2-week trip or a 3-week trip. You need to go down there, and to see wildlife and film, you have to be there for quite an extended period of time. So I would love to travel down to the bottom of our planet, Antarctica, and I'd love to get into underwater with the leopard seals. I've seen that sequences that have been shot before, and these extraordinary animals that you can have very, very close encounters with. There's a sort of fear factor as well, because they're big, they're scary, they are potentially dangerous, but they're very, very, very beautiful. So yeah, if I could do anything, if I was to chuck something into that bucket, Antarctica to get under the ice with leopard seals, that would be it.
Oh, incredible. Thank you so much, Gordon Buchanan. Those were your travel diaries. It has been wonderful getting to hear them. Thank you.
Thank you so much. It's been a real pleasure.
Oh, that was Gordon Buchanan. I hope you enjoyed that as much as I did. If you want to hear more from Gordon, you're in luck, because he has a tour coming up in January and February next year. Gordon Buchanan, 30 Years in the Wild, the anniversary tour, with dates all across the UK. Tickets are available online at gordon-buchanan.co.uk. And thank you so much for listening today. If you've enjoyed today's episode, don't forget to subscribe on your podcast app so that you don't miss an episode. It's really easy to do that. On Apple, they've just changed it so that you follow rather than subscribe by pressing the plus sign in the top right-hand corner of the app. I would also be so grateful if you could leave a rating or a review. It really helps other people to discover the podcast. To find out who's joining me next week, follow me on Instagram at Holly Rubenstein. I'd love to hear from you. And if you can't wait until then, there's all of seasons 1, 2, 3, and 4 to catch up on. Thanks again. Take care, and I'll be back with you next week. Today's episode is supported by Airbnb, and what a great partnership. If you're a longtime listener of the Travel Diaries, you probably know that we love to put our home on Airbnb when we're traveling. Like last autumn, when we took the family to Puglia, we put our house on Airbnb when otherwise it would just be sitting empty, which meant that we earned some extra money that went towards our flights and maybe some souvenirs too. Hosting on Airbnb for us is also a family affair. My mum is an Airbnb superhost. She regularly has guests stay in her little chalet in her garden. And my dad, who lives in France, has his home on Airbnb so that when he comes back to visit, he is earning some extra money while he's away. My dad is 80 and he only started hosting on Airbnb a couple of years ago. So hopefully that shows you how straightforward the whole experience is. He found it so easy to list his house that I think he's got all his pals signing up now too. And it really is straightforward. You can choose whether you want to rent out your entire home or just some rooms. Alex and I, for example, list our spare bedroom, and that works really well for us. So if you have a trip coming up and you want to earn some extra money while you're away, your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.co.uk/host. That's airbnb.co.uk/host. Thank you to Airbnb.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.